We celebrate today the memory of our Lord going to Lebanon. And we know this story well. This story always falls in our liturgical cycle as we're beginning to prepare for the great fast. It is a wonderful conjunction, however, today, as it falls also within the octave of the great feast of the encounter of our Lord in the temple. The feast that we celebrate this octave, the encounter of the Lord and the blessing of candles, as we will at the end of the liturgy, is a celebration of the light of Christ shining in the darkness. The light of Christ, the light in the darkness, the light to the Gentiles. This image, of course, you find throughout the Old Testament, most importantly in Isaiah chapter 9, when we hear about a great light which will shine in the darkness for the Gentiles, those who sat in darkness. Galilee of the Gentiles. Jesus, after about 3 years of his earthly ministry, primarily spending his time only among the Jews, at the very end of his ministry, headed off into Gentile land. For us, a thought of Lebanon might make us think of a beautiful beach, a nice vacation. But for the Jews, heading into Lebanon, this is heading into Gentile territory. There will be no way to avoid Gentiles there. In Jerusalem and Galilee, you might see a Roman soldier, some pagan, some Gentile walking down the street. You would, of course, make sure you avoided them. You couldn't even touch them if you were a Jew. If you came in contact, you had to bathe, and you would be still considered unclean until sunset, that is, till the next day. Jesus told his disciples earlier in the ministry, when he first sent them out for a bit of a practice run. He sent them out midway through his ministry. The Gospels record this, and Jesus says to the disciples, in this very same Gospel in Matthew, go nowhere among the Gentiles. Don't even go to the house of a Samaritan, which were kind of half-breeds. Right? They were descendants of the northern kingdom of Israel. Remnants of the northern tribes mixed in with Gentile blood. He says, don't even go to one of those. Do not go anywhere except to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. So the disciples went out, and you know, and they spent their time among the Jewish towns and villages, and then they come back and they tell Jesus what happened. He says, that was very nice. There's more to it, and I'll explain that later. And so then he continues his ministry. At the very end of his ministry, he multiplies bread. He multiplies bread. And you know this story about the multiplication of the five loaves, right? The five loaves for the 5,000 and the 12 baskets that were taken up of crumbs left over. This shows that not only has Jesus completed his ministry to the Jews, the five loaves, the 5,000, all the commentators point out that this is a reference to not only that there were five loaves and there were 5,000, but Matthew tells us about this number for a reason, because the five reminds us of the Torah, the five books of Moses. And that is confirmed, in fact, when we hear that they picked up the crumbs 12 baskets full, a symbol of Israel, the 12 tribes. Even the word in Greek there, kofinos, is the word for the type of basket they used in Palestine in that region. But there were 12 baskets of crumbs left over. There's still time in Jesus' ministry. And so, before heading to Jerusalem, he takes his disciples on a little vacation to Lebanon. You can imagine the disciples, where are we going? Why are we going to Gentile land? Jesus had said we were to only go to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. Why are we going among the Gentiles? As they arrive, can you imagine? Where are we going to get food? Kosher food? At the restaurants, they'll be serving bacon, and for lunch, cheese on the burgers. They'll be surrounded by Gentiles. What was Jesus doing? Well, he was showing his disciples something. That while he was primarily sent in his ministry for those 3 years to the Jews, first and foremost, ultimately his ministry was for the sake of all of mankind. God had called Abraham in Genesis chapter 12. After we hear in chapters 10 and 11 about all of the nations that come from Noah and his sons after the flood, we hear about 70, 72, depending on how you want to count them, nations that come from Noah and his sons after the flood. And then we hear about God picking one man. You, come here. I got a job for you. And what is his job? He doesn't say, Abraham, I will make you a great nation. I will give you a great name. I will bless your children because I don't like anyone else. No, God's not a Calvinist. He said, so that through your seed, all the nations might be blessed. Abraham was called from the nations for the sake of the nations from which he was called. This is why this gospel, the Gospel of Matthew, begins by telling us that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of David, the Messiah, the Son of Abraham. Well, what Son of David is not a Son of Abraham? It's the order of operations here. He reminds us of that Jesus is not only Son of David, the great long-awaited Messiah, the returned King of the Jews, but ultimately, we have to remember that the whole point of David, the whole point of the Jews, the whole point of the temple, the whole point of all the salvation history was to fulfill that promise to Abraham. And so Matthew reminds us that he's Son of David, Son of Abraham. And this is why this Gospel of Matthew concludes with Jesus telling us, telling his disciples, go out and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and of the Son and the Holy Spirit, and teaching them all that I have taught you. Well, Jesus saying that, go out among all nations, is certainly very different from what he said earlier to the disciples, go only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel, go only among the Jews. Something has happened here. Jesus has showed his disciples that while he is the Messiah, the King of the Jews, the purpose of David, the purpose of Solomon, the purpose of the temple, the purpose of the Messiah, the purpose of all of this, the purpose of the Jews, the descendants of Abraham, was so that through them, all the nations could come to know the one true God that revealed himself to Abraham and to his descendants at Mount Sinai. That there was only one true God, one Father, who created all things and who desires, as St. Paul says, that all men be saved. And so Jesus, after having ministered to the Jews, to reveal to them who he is, that he is their long-awaited Messiah, then showed his disciples that ultimately the purpose of all of this, the purpose of him coming, the purpose of the 12 tribes, which he's reconstituted in these 12 apostles, is to be the children, the descendant of Abraham, through whom all the nations shall be blessed. Jesus is that son, as St. Paul says in his letter to the Galatians. He is that seed through whom all the nations are blessed. And so Jesus shows his disciples that while he began his ministry among the Jews, ultimately, it is for the Gentiles as well. And so he now turns to the Gentiles. And when he comes there, his disciples react as you would expect. This woman comes up, who has a demon-possessed child. Just like we saw among the Jews. And she comes up to Jesus. The story reminds us of stories we've already heard. But now this is a Gentile. She comes up to Jesus and says, "Lord, help me." There's no answer. He's waiting. And his disciples say what you would expect them to say. "Lord, get rid of this woman. She's bothering us. We're on vacation. We're in Lebanon. Look at the beach." Jesus waits. The woman continues to cry out, "Lord, help me." And then Jesus says what he had said to his disciples to remind them about the two stages of the ministry. He then says the exact same thing he had told his disciples at the first stage of the ministry. He says, "I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." That is, the primary purpose of my earthly ministry here for these 3 years is to convert the Jews into what they were supposed to be. So that through God's people, all the nations could be blessed. And so he reminds them of that with this phrase that echoes back to his command when he had first sent them out. "Go nowhere among the Gentiles. Only go to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." Then the woman keeps crying out. And Jesus says, "It is not right to give bread for the children of the household to the dogs." Correct? What does this mean? This is some strange language. I think out of all of Jesus' sayings, this is the one that bothers people the most. Especially if any are from Lebanon. What's he saying about this nice Lebanese girl? There is nothing more despicable in the Jewish mind than a dog. Right, we think of a swine. Okay? The swine is kind of a high-profile animal in the kosher laws because it tastes good. It smells good when it's on the barbecue. But you can't eat it. Okay, so we think of hogs and swine as a regular image of what the Jews couldn't eat because we eat 3 times a day. It's a big item. Okay, big ticket item. But there, a hog was not, for the Jew, the most despicable, disgusting creature. It was just forbidden. They could not eat it. Why? Because the Gentiles eat it. And if you eat with Gentiles, you're invited over for a barbecue at their house, and you eat what they eat, then before you know it, you're going to be worshiping the gods of the Gentiles. You become a pagan. So God put certain barriers around them. Certain things they couldn't do that were Gentile-type activities to keep a cultural barrier, to keep his people from falling back into polytheism, to keep them on the track of their original calling, to be that one through whom all the nations would be blessed. Jesus says it is not right for the dogs to eat the bread of the children. Now you've got to think about this. Bread, what do we think of bread? Today, with Dr. Atkins, I'm sure bread maybe doesn't have the same image as it would for people in the ancient world. Bread is food. Okay? Lechem in Hebrew. It means bread, yes, but it means food in general. Artos in Greek. Yes, it means specifically bread. But in general, it just means food. Because except for our modern world in America, where we have a nice big plate with a huge chunk of meat and whatever we want on the plate, everyone else in the world, for the most part, especially if you go back a century ago, had a big plate with bread on it. That's what you ate. Bread wasn't a little roll on the side, or, "Oh, thank you, I can't eat that stuff now." No, that was what you ate. Every day, if you had enough, you saw, as you grew up as a child, your mother make some bread, and then bake it, and then bring it to the father of the home. And the family would gather around, and he would thank God for this meal, for this bread, this loaf. And he would break it in pieces, his number of how many were in the room, and he would give them all. And they would each get a hunk of bread, and they would eat it. And that was dinner. That was their meal for the day. If they were lucky, they might be able to do this twice a day. This was it, basically. Bread was food. And so, To say to give the bread for the children to the dogs, hopefully you can see the context here. This is to give it an American cultural idea. It's like to say, imagine you were sitting at the Thanksgiving meal. Everyone's gathered around. And the mother, the wife of the home has made a beautiful meal. She's been cooking for days. And everyone's gathered and ready. And the turkey is brought to the table. And the man of the house is handed a knife. And everyone's smelling the turkey. And then he looks around. And he gathers up the tablecloth, picks it up, walks outside, dumps it out for the Labrador Retriever, and says, "Good, Rover, enjoy it." And walks back in. Can you imagine anything more offensive than this? To the people, the guests, and to his poor wife. What are we going to do? What are we going to eat? What are you doing? So to take the bread, the meal, and cast it to the dogs, that is the mangy creatures running around outside. Don't think you're a Labrador Retriever, okay? A dog back then was the things in the back alleys and, you know, rabies and everything. Mangy. The Jews were supposed to be the children of God. In Hebrew, to be a son of, this idiom in Hebrew, to be a son of, means not only to be literally a genetic son of, but to be what a genetic son usually is, a follower, an imitator of. Okay? This is why we have in our spiritual language, which we get from the Jews, the Old Testament, the idea that someone who is your spiritual director or leader is called father, and then the one who is your director is called son, or child, or daughter. This is the idea. And so, the Israelites who were not doing what they were supposed to be, God's children, to be the one through whom all the nations would be blessed, the sons of Abraham, that seed. Jesus has come to them to teach them what they were to be. And so now standing in Lebanon with this woman, she cries out again and says, "Oh Lord, you are right. Yes, it is not right," she agrees, "it's not right that the bread be tossed to the dogs. But Lord, there are 12 baskets left over." Jesus still has time in his ministry. And the sign that there was still time are those 12 baskets that were left over. The crumbs, a great bounty. The Jews have had their fill. For 3 years, Jesus has preached to them. And now, he turns to the Gentiles and begins to feed them. But the Gentiles are going to come in, not by right of descendancy from Abraham, but rather through the faith of Abraham. And so he requires of this woman faith. You might think he's being a little tough on her. She's a Canaanite woman. Do you know who the Canaanites are? When was the first time you heard about the Canaanites? Well, back in chapter 10 of Genesis, in this whole story we're talking about with Abraham. The Canaanites, the descendants of Ham, have heard the law of Moses since the time Moses and the Israelites left Egypt. They have known the law of Moses since Joshua brought the people into the Promised Land. That's 1,500 years before this moment in Lebanon. 1,500 years. They've had an opportunity to repent and join the people of God. She's had plenty of time. Her descendants, her ancestors. And so Jesus asks of her great faith. And she responds with great faith. She says, "Yes, Lord, you are right. I understand what you're saying. I have no right for you to heal my daughter. I am not a descendant of Abraham by blood, but I am by faith. Yes, Lord, but even the dogs eat the bread that fall from the master's table. There is a great bounty left over." This is a teaching moment for his disciples. And he now turns to the woman and says, "Great is your faith." This is the faith of Abraham. As St. Paul says in his letter to the Galatians, he says, in his letter to the Romans, It is those who have the faith of Abraham who are the sons and the children of Abraham. It is those who have the faith of Abraham who are the sons of God, the children of God. And then Jesus heads back into Galilee. But do you remember where he goes next? He does not head back to the spot where he took off. He took off from Gennesaret, over on the west side of the sea. This is a Jewish town. When he comes back down onto the eastern shore of the Sea of Galilee. Do you remember what happened last time he was there? He didn't encounter dogs, but hogs. Last time he was there in Galilee of the Gentiles, on the other side, he went there and he found a demon-possessed man, just like we have in this situation. The demons are all over the Gentiles, of course. And after he heals this man, the Gentiles have nothing to do with him. Do you know why? Because he ruined their economy. He just sent herds of swine that was the economic support for this community, this village. He sent them into the ocean, into the sea, and they were gone dead. Could you imagine being one of the farmers, being one of the members of this little Gentile village, looking out at all of your dead animals floating in the water? This guy's trouble. Please get out of here. We don't want any of this. We'll keep our demons. Thank you. Go away. That's what Jesus gets in a boat. But now he's come back. His disciples are now ready. And those Gentiles are now ready. And so he comes back onto the eastern side, back near that same spot. And great crowds of Gentiles gathered to him. These are Gentiles. And it says he healed them. And he preached and taught them. And they glorified, Matthew says, the God of Israel. Showing that these are Gentiles who are now coming into the faith. And this Syrophoenician woman, this Lebanese lady, is the beginning of that story. She is the beginning of all of our story, who are not of any kind of blood descendancy from Abraham. And so this woman is a very important story, and also therefore is a very important story for us to celebrate in the midst of the octave of the encounter. In the encounter of Jesus in the temple as a small boy, we have a hint at this very story of the Canaanite woman. We have a hint at what's coming at the end of his ministry when he sends them out to baptize all nations. We have a hint that he is that seed of Abraham through which all the nations shall be blessed. Because when Simeon takes him up in his hands, he says, "Now you can dismiss your servant, O Lord, for my eyes have seen the salvation of Israel, a light to the Gentiles." A light to the Gentiles. Now that's a nice bit of history, Father Sebastian. That's very nice. We understand the encounter and the Canaanite woman. But what does that mean for me? And this is the question we need to ask. What does the story of Jesus mean today? Why are we celebrating 2,000 years later Jesus being brought into a Jewish temple? Why are we talking 2,000 years later about Jesus' disciples going to this pagan land and bringing about the salvation of this woman and her child and the rest? Because in the end, when Jesus was brought into the temple and shown to be the light to the nations, we saw the light, a glimmer of who we are supposed to be. We might like to sit in judgment upon the Jews who did not do what they were supposed to do for all those years, who received the law, as St. Stephen says, but did not keep it, even at Mount Sinai. And all of the sin of the people all the way for the next 1,500 years. We might look on the Jews and say, oh, look at how they failed and failed and failed, though they had the Torah. They should have known better. Jesus came to them and their lives were not changed. And then we need to look in the mirror. And then we need to look in the mirror and realize who we are and ask the question, are we any different from the Jews? Am I a light in the darkness to those around me? To my family, my friends? Am I a light in the darkness in this God-forsaken city? Am I a light in the darkness in my workplace? Am I a light in the darkness wherever I am? I'd have to say that I'm not. I haven't been the light in the darkness that I should have been my entire life. And I don't think there's a day that goes by that I don't fail again and again to be that light. I think we can all probably say that. But Jesus is a merciful God. And when we fail to be that light which we have become through our baptism into Him, we have been baptized into Him, St. Paul says. We have put on Christ like a garment. Galatians 3:27. We have become members of His body, St. Paul tells us. We are Christ in this world. Whether you like it or not, it's very nice and easy to talk about Jesus and what He did, but now we need to remember who we are by virtue of our baptism. Who have we become? And what we may not actually be now. Are we a light in the darkness? In our workplace? When customers come to our business, do they know that we are Christians, first and foremost? In the workplace, in the next desk or cubicle, do they know that you at that desk, who sits at that desk, is a Christian? Does your neighbor know that you are a Christian in the apartment or the house next to you? Or does your house, does your desk, does your workplace look just like your Hindu neighbor or your Buddhist neighbor? Do we, when we are in school, for the young ones among us, or in college, do those sitting next to us in the desk, or in the out in the at play in the recess, do they know that we are Christians? Can they come up to us with questions about the faith? Do they know that? Is there any sign that we are a light in the darkness? Are our words any different than our pagan neighbor? Is our clothing any different than our pagan neighbor? Do we wear a cross outside of our clothing? Or do we hide it under a bushel basket, like put it in our shirt? Afraid what people might say, might do. We are to be a light in the darkness, and I'll tell you what, if we don't shine brightly, we're going to face in this country, we already are, it's already happening, the same persecution that Christians are suffering all over the world. In just the last few years, thousands and thousands of Christians were put to death by the sword of Islam. Right now as we speak, Christians are being put to death and imprisoned in China. You don't think that's coming here? Syria? Syria. The heart of early Christianity. Antioch? Antioch. The city from which our faith has come to us. We are the Church of Antioch. And what is going on in Antioch right now? It's a Muslim city. A few Christians running around, but they can't do much. What's going on in Jerusalem? The Christians are there, they run the place? Some of you are here who have seen your relatives, your friends die by Muslims, by Jews. You've seen property confiscated, houses taken. You don't think that's going to come here? Watch the news. Look at what the politicians are saying. Look what just happened in New York. When abortion became legal in this country, when the killing of babies in the womb of their mother, the most sacred and the most supposed to be the most safe and secure spot on earth. What did we do? Where were our bishops? Where were the Christians? And now, in New York, it is signed into law. This has always been allowed, of course, since Roe versus Wade, but the states are doing this, of course, because they're anticipating the overturn of Roe versus Wade at the federal level. And so they're getting ready. They're already digging their trenches. These are the states doing this. The Democrats and the liberal politicians in all the states, which many people, Christians even, helped tragically to elect just a few months ago, are now digging trenches, getting ready for the big battle. Because when Roe versus Wade is overturned at the federal level, it won't make any difference. Because the states will have already put in to law the protection of abortion rights. And so we are looking at a long, drawn-out battle. State to state. It could take another century. Now, of course, those who support these kinds of things are actually willing to talk about what they're doing. Now, of course, in New York and in Virginia, they're talking about really what they've always wanted in the first place. That is, not only the death of children in the womb, but if a child happens to be born, which is an accident, which wasn't supposed to come out at that moment, survive the abortion, or maybe it's just not the kind of kid the person wanted, the mother and the doctor should have the right to do what they need to do. That's what the governor of Virginia said on public radio the other day. Democrat elected by Christians. Christian votes did that. This is where this is all going. They're killing the unborn. They're killing those who are born. They're killing the elderly. You know, the elderly are afraid and the sick are afraid to go to hospitals in Sweden and Denmark now. They don't go because they know if they go there, they'll never come back. They'll go to sleep and never wake up. Euthanasia is everywhere. Euthanasia. How ironic. Good death? I don't think so. This is what is happening in this country. Wake up, America. Wake up, St. Elias. Wake up, Christians. And be a light in the darkness.